Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a little bit as we continue to go through the baseball card collection now. Yeah, we're widening our horizons here. We're no longer just in the big old monster box. We've moved on from the big old monster box, went through the miscellaneous box, and have found ourselves in the big old binder. By our listeners' request, we have shifted the focus of the show to the earlier year cards, and it's going to be fun. I was actually flipping through the binder over the weekend, and a lot of really cool cards, great players to talk about. We will do our random pull from these cards. My collection in this era stretches from 1954 to 1980. Now, I do not have cards for 1955 or 56. I'm sure a quick shopping trip on eBay will take care of that one day. But for now, we're going to go from 1954, skip ahead to 57, and then go through 1980. And with the binder, much like the big old monster box, you know, the box I had some years I would have just a handful of cards, other years I had a couple hundred. Same thing here with the vintage cards. Some years I have a couple, some years I have 40 or 50 or 60, and some years I have one. And 1954 is one of those years, although I've got an interesting story behind how I ended up with this card. It is very much beaten up. But a very interesting story about that, my preference for older cards. It is card number 156. This would have been a high series number for Topps in 1954. Joe Coleman. No, not the Joe Coleman who you may know as a pitching coach. No, this was actually Joe Coleman, the pitching coach's father. So Joe Coleman Sr. And we've got stories about the Coleman family that I'll share with you. Stories about this team that Joe Coleman is pictured with, the Baltimore Orioles. There's a fascinating story behind the Baltimore Orioles and the team that he was with in 1953, which if you look closely at this card, he's actually pictured in their uniforms. Topps, you know, we've made a lot of fun about Topps. You know, airbrushing their cards over the years for guys who change teams, but they actually did a pretty good job of covering up the old Philadelphia Athletics logos. And we'll talk about that in a little bit because there is a common theme with the Philadelphia Athletics and the Baltimore Orioles, or their predecessor, the St. Louis Browns, and that, of course, is Bill Veeck. So we got a whole lot to talk about here in our latest podcast as we go back in time to 1954. Now, before we get to our Twitter mentions at Wax and Gum Stains, I want to pass along a little bit of news about our distribution. No, this is not the big exciting news I wanted to share with you. I haven't gotten confirmation of that yet. So hopefully I will find out something within the next couple of days, and then we can make that announcement in our next podcast. But it involves our next podcast. I've made the decision, and this is partially on our survey results. This is also partially on the responses that I get at Wax and Gum Stains. For now, and we'll just see how this works, but for now, we're going to scale back the release of the show to just once a week on Tuesdays. So again, Wax Ecstatic will be coming your way, at least for the near future, once a week. Couple of reasons why I'm deciding to do this. Actually, three reasons. One, doing the podcast twice a week, while it was very aggressive in building our show and building our fan base, it gets to be a little too much trying to balance work and life. And this is a fun thing that I'm doing here, but I've got to find the right time to balance everything else out. So it allows me to step back just a little bit while continuing to bring you the show. The second reason why we're scaling it back to one day, again, at least just for now, we'll see how it works out, is that based on our survey results, we asked the question, you know, if we did it just once a week, would you be upset or you don't care? And an overwhelming amount, I think it was like 78%, said, it doesn't matter, keep it coming. So, you know, only a handful of people were upset if we didn't come your way twice a week, but the vast majority said once is fine or however often, just keep the shows coming. So you're in general okay with this based on, you know, our survey results. So I will go ahead and take you up on that offer there. Now, what that means, and this is the third reason why we're scaling it back, is It gives you a chance to catch up. And reading some of our mentions through Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, I can see that, you know, it's good to have all of these shows that we've done, but for some people, it's too many, especially if you're just joining Wax Ecstatic. If you've just started listening to us over the last few weeks or even couple months, you know, you've got almost 70 episodes to go back and listen to. So we're going to slow it down a little bit here, not just for my benefit, but for your benefit as well. And what this will do is it will allow us to do a couple things. First of all, I've decided on Fridays, we'll do a flashback Friday. So I will go back through the archives, find some of my favorite shows, some of my favorite cards or players on those cards. And we will feature that in Flashback Friday form. So if you missed a podcast, you can, you know, basically take my suggestion that this is a really good one and listen back to it. Or if you've heard it a couple times before, it's been, especially with some of our earlier releases, which came back out in, you know, September and October, you know, it's been several months. So it's a chance for you to catch up and listen to it once again, and maybe you'll find some detail in that show that you missed out before. Now, the other thing that it does for us, too, is it opens up the possibility of doing some of the more creative stuff that some of you suggested doing, whether it's having a guest on, and we did do a guest episode once. If it's, you know, doing a pack break, whether it's, you know, one of my packs, or, you know, if a fan wants to, you know, submit money and, you know, I buy the stuff and then open the pack. I know most people were fine with an audio podcast, but maybe we get a chance to do something video. Well, opening that up on a Friday, that is a possibility, especially during the summer when things slow down for me at my work. And, you know, we can get a little more creative and do something just a little out of the ordinary from the usual podcast. So I'm appreciative of our listeners. I'm having a lot of fun with the podcast, but again, for reasons for me to scale it down just a little bit, for you to consume it at a much easier pace. You're not listening to 65 hours of podcast trying to catch up on things here. We're going to do that moving forward. And again, at some point in time, we may ramp things back up to two podcasts a week, but I figured now is the time to do it. With us switching gears, going back to the 1950s and moving forward. And, you know, now's kind of good time to shake it up just a little bit. Now, again, I do hope to have the exciting news on our distribution in our next podcast. So next Tuesday, when we flip the page to 1957 Tops, I hope to be able to share that with you. Although, because I don't have the podcast on Friday, the new podcast, just keep an eye on Wax and Gum Stains on your Twitter feed. If you're not already following, please do. Because if we get the news before then we'll put it out there and share it with you that way. All right, now speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, a lot of great responses from our miscellaneous shows, including the team sets, as Adam Donovan chimes in, still trying to catch up. See what I mean about, you know, slowing things down for your benefit. Still trying to catch up, but wanted to share favorite team set, Denver Police Rockies 1997. Clean look and nice photos. And he sends us a picture of, looks like about 10 or 12 cards. The Rockies at one of their best points in time. I know they were in the World Series in 2007, but, you know, still in their early stages in 1997 and making the playoffs and generating some excitement. And it is a nice clean design there. And the fact that it was, you know, sponsored by a local company too, again, the main focal point of a lot of team sets, finding a sponsor that would put the money into the product and then, you know, being able to distribute it on baseball card day or, you know, throughout other avenues later on down the line. Talking about the wild pitchers, this goes back to a card that Joey W. sent us, the great Mark Wohlers, who, as we mentioned, got really wild, and we brought up a few names. Rick Ankiel was one. I brought up Kevin Saucier as well. Peter Steinberg chimes in. Another pitcher in the Wohlers Ankiel category is Daniel Bard, formerly of the Red Sox. Yes, the team responsible for breaking him. Yeah, totally forgot about Daniel Bard, so thank you for that reminder, Peter. Tim Murray, about no logo cards. The missing logo is why I can't take Panini seriously. Their cards reminded me of cheap grocery releases, and that's the exact same reason I'm not a big fan of it. If you don't have the blessing of the Players Association or Major League Baseball to have the logos and team names on there, it does look like a cheap knockoff, no matter how nationally known Panini and their Donruss brand is. It's just not quite the same. And then, you know, you start trying to bring back old designs and ripping off other card company designs and trying to call it new. It's just very, very cheap. Now, we mentioned in the no-logo cards, a lot of the no-logo cards were serial cards. And Sleep Frank, our friend in San Diego, sends a few scans of his favorite 62 post cards. And you have Roger Maris and Don Drysdale and Mickey Mantle, and some great cards here. Now, these did have the logos, so this was before the Players Association, of course, so Major League Baseball signed off on this, but this was the very common avenue of getting cards, the cereal boxes, having Topps make these cards for post and just dropping them into cereal boxes. So that was a great way for cards to get into the hands of new collectors there. And if you weren't already buying baseball cards at the, you know, local drugstore, you could find one floating around in the box of cereal that you were eating every morning. Now, in response to just miscellaneous cards in general, Ben Adams says, was always a pain trying to organize when you came across those. Yeah. And that's how, you know, I went through my collection actually probably about a year ago, because I started stocking up on, you know, Topps Heritage especially, but a lot of the newer Topps releases. And by the way, 2017 Topps Heritage in the 1968 Topps design, an absolute winner. I absolutely love that set. Even ended up with an autograph card, Clarence Jones. So I pulled the autographed Clarence Jones card, and right beneath the autographed Clarence Jones, I got another Rediscover Topps card. It was, what year was it? An 86 Braves team checklist with my favorite and Wax Ecstatic listener Dale Murphy. By the way, happy birthday, Murph. I know your birthday was, I believe, this past Sunday. So I appreciate you listening in. But anyways, you know, I'm going through all of the cards, and, you know, there's just a handful of cards that I didn't throw out, or I didn't want to throw out, or I didn't sell, or I don't even want to try selling. And they ended up in the miscellaneous box. So when all hope just gave up that I could put it in a box with all these other cards, I just went, eh, I'll just kind of end up in this stack. And then the stack got big enough to justify a box. Let's see. The Snorting Bull. Someone once bought me Senior League cards. Those were in the miscellaneous box along with checklist, contest cards, etc. You know, checklist, if it's an old enough set, I actually, you know, put those in plastic sheets because, you know, the checklist back in the day, kids actually used it as a checklist. So it's hard to find, you know, purely mint condition cards in the checklist form. So I actually keep those in decent shape, even though they're kind of boring to look at. Contest cards, you know, I sent out the picture of the Topps store cards. That wasn't necessarily a contest card, but it was one of those filler cards. But yeah, the old scratch-off cards. Yep. What else? The stickers, you know, Fleer stickers. If I didn't stick them to a box, I kept them. And I've actually, over the years, I used those as dividers. So, you know, if I have a box that says, you know, like 1991 through 93 Topps or whatever, then what I'll do is I'll take, you know, a handful of these old Fleer stickers from like 1985, and that's how I divide the different years of top sets there. So we all have a miscellaneous box, and I do encourage you, if you haven't done so, go through the miscellaneous box, because you will find a gem or two. When I went through and did that show last week, you know, again, finding some of those cards, I was just like, wow, I totally forgot I even had this. Or, you know what, this card wasn't as bad as I thought it was. So I'm glad I hung on to it. Kevin Hickerson picked up a box of this for nostalgic purposes today. Can't wait to break it. Would have killed to do this 26 years ago. And what is this? It is a box of 91 Topps Baseball. Enjoy that, Kevin. One of my favorite sets. And as I've said on our podcast about that set, the last fun baseball card set. And finally, C&M Collectibles just joined us and has been listening to the podcast. Says, keep up the good work. Love the podcast. Thank you very much. And also adds, having been a Royals fan my entire life, I remember Boardwalk and baseball fondly. And that was part of our miscellaneous podcast. And, you know, I remember it so well because, like I said in the podcast, I was very fortunate to live relatively close to Boardwalk and Baseball. And because it was much more affordable than Disney World, my family went there. And it was, as I mentioned, part of the Anheuser-Busch family theme park group, along with Busch Gardens and SeaWorld and Cypress Gardens. So back in 89 or 90, when my parents had the family pass, it was really worth the money. I mean, you spent like $60 for, you know, per member for an annual pass, but you had four parks and it was very exciting. So yeah, I remember Boardwalk and Baseball, and every time I drive by where it was, and I see that big shopping mall just sitting there at the edge of I-4 and Highway 27 in Claremont, I think, what could have been? Imagine if they just kind of reinvested into this and made it a big baseball complex. No, it's a shopping mall, because Florida just doesn't have enough shopping malls. I mean, really, what's the difference between one Target and another? What's the difference between one JCPenney and another? See which one goes out of business first. It's just, I don't know why we have so many of them down here. All right, for any commentary on Wax Ecstatic, be it on the cards we talk about the players we talk about anything else in the business, feel free to chime in at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter at any time. And please tell your friends that they should join in the conversation as well. If they're current collectors, past collectors, there's definitely something exciting to talk about on Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And again, pass along the word, for the near future, we'll be doing a podcast just once a week. The new podcast comes out on Tuesdays. And right now for Fridays, we will be doing a Flashback Friday, bringing back some of our favorite podcasts for you to listen to for the first time, or maybe listen to again and see what you may have missed the first time around. And I appreciate you listening to our show. Appreciate your input. Again, it wasn't just for me to kind of dial things back a little bit, but mostly because you said, hey, once a week's fine with us. And by the way, I'm still catching up on the 60 previous episodes I haven't listened to yet. So that will give you a little bit of a breather to do so. All right, let's take a look at our card here from 1954. Joe Coleman, card number 156. A little information about the 54 top set. This was at the tail end of the bloody battle for player contracts between Topps and Bowman. Of course, Bowman is now part of Topps, has been since the late 1980s. But back then, they were two separate companies, and they fought like crazy to get the rights to having players' names and likenesses used on these cards. And there was an epic battle back and forth, and especially with Ted Williams. Ted Williams did not sign with Topps. He would sign with Bowman. Well, finally, in 1954, Williams signed with Topps, and Topps was so excited, they not only featured Williams on the cardboard boxes that held the wax packs, but they also made two cards for him that year. And this is back in the day when Topps was only a 250 card set. Series 1 was cards 1 through 50. Series 2 was cards 51 through 75. And then Series 3 was 76 through 250. So card number 1 and card number 250 are both Ted Williams cards. And what's interesting is it's very hard to find these cards in pristine mint condition because it bookended the entire set. And this being 1954, if you collected cards, if you didn't already run them through the spokes of your bicycle wheels, then you rubber banded them together. So if you put them together in sequential order and you had maybe not the whole set, but let's say you had 100 of these cards, but you had number 1 and number 250 as the bookends, they got rubbed pretty raw by the rubber bands. So finding a gem mint Ted Williams from 1954 is damn near impossible because, I mean, you almost have to pull it out of a pack now just because people took care of their cards in a completely different way back then. Now, I would highly recommend reading Dave Jameson's book, Mint Condition, if you haven't already. That gives you the full details of the battle between Topps and Bowman. And by 1954, they're offering all sorts of cash incentives to get the players to sign contracts to be on their card. So some players would appear in one set, but not the other. Other players would appear in no sets, and then other players would appear in two sets. So it kind of went back and forth, and Topps, with the major coup in 1954, getting Ted Williams to sign. Now, 54 Topps also featured the rookie cards of Henry Aaron and Ernie Banks and Al Kaline. Plus, you had some of the biggest up-and-coming stars of that time, Willie Mays, Jackie Robinson, of course. This is a set that's just, even though it's only 250 cards, chock full of star players here. And I have seen, you know, some people have been able to actually collect the entire set here, and I've seen complete sets going for like $14,000-$15,000. If you're able to get your hands on a wax pack, God bless you. These are still floating around there. You know, some collectors have hung on to them for a few years, when I mean that, a few decades. And there are still 1954 Topps packs floating around there, sold for 1 cent back then. Of course, the bubble gum was the big thing back then, but you would get four cards in each pack. And 1954 was also, I believe, the last year that Topps had the oversized card, the same size of 89 Bowman that drives fans crazy, measuring at 2 5/8 inch by 3 3/4 inches. So these do not fit in your standard plastic sheets. So for me, this card is actually in the binder, but it is in a top loader, a wider top loader, and it's just kind of floating on top of the plastic sheets. But again, I only have one card from 1954, so it's not that big of a deal. But the cards were a little slightly oversized, but Topps was trying to advance the product. If you look back at 1951, 52, 53 Topps, they were all paintings of players. Well, 1954 was the first year that Topps included not only the painting of a player, but an action shot of the player. So the fronts of these cards each have two pictures. You have the painting, which takes up the entire front of the card, and then the action shot is a black and white photo that is cropped into, you know, one of the lower corners of the cards. And you can see that with this Joe Coleman card here, as you know, his portrait is off to the left, taking up much of the space, and then his action shot, which is him in a windup, is on the right side. And the unique thing about the fronts of the cards for Topps, and a lot of people mistakenly think that they're miscut or off center, the tops of the cards did not have a white border on purpose. Topps actually built this into the design where the top of the card is a color, and then there is a slender white border around the other three edges. So if you get a 1954 Topps card, however you get it, through a pack or through a garage sale or an estate sale or whatever, don't get upset and think that the tops of the cards have been all cut off. No, that's actually by design. So you have varying colors behind the players. In the case of Joe Coleman, it's kind of this light blue. I know the Hank Aaron card, which is very popular, has kind of this gold background to it. So those vary. But you have the player's name across the top, his position and team right beneath it, the team logo in the upper right-hand corner, although that would vary, again, based on where the portrait was. You know, for example, if you look at the Henry Aaron card, you know, Hank's picture is on the right, so the old Milwaukee Braves logo is on the left. So that kind of floats around there. And I've got to tell you, I absolutely love this old Baltimore Oriole logo. And this was the first year of this edition of the Baltimore Orioles. The original Baltimore Orioles of the 1901 American League played 2 years in Baltimore, then moved to New York, renamed themselves the Highlanders, and are better known now today as the Yankees. But the Orioles' first logo from 1954 is great. And I actually saw somebody tweeted out a lineup. The Orioles were playing one of the World Baseball Classic teams. I forget which team they were playing. But somebody tweeted out the lineup. And the lineup card that they were using in spring training had essentially this logo. It didn't have the bird on top, but it had the baseball and the Orioles written just like this in beneath the stitching. And I thought that was very cool. And the Orioles are not celebrating one of those nice round numbers, you know, 50, 60 years in Baltimore. You know, now this is 63 years. But I thought that was very neat that they were able to incorporate that into, you know, spring training lineup. this year. Now, a little more about the front of this card and about Joe Coleman before we flip it over to the back. If you look carefully, you know, obviously there was no pictures of anybody with the Baltimore Orioles early on because, you know, the Orioles had just moved from St. Louis. But even though this was the third series or the higher series, it was released a little later in the spring than the first two series. But some fine work with the artwork by the top staff on the Orioles cap, not only in the color portrait, but also in the action shot here. And in fact, I believe just looking at this Coleman card, this isn't a painting. This is an actual portrait of him. So they did a real bang up job of the Oriole hat, because if you look at Coleman's jersey, he's clearly wearing a Philadelphia Athletics jersey from 1953. So they didn't edit out the piping that was in there. But I thought that was some pretty nifty handwork there by the top staff to make that happen there. We'll talk a little more about the Orioles and the Browns and the Athletics in just a little bit. But love that logo, and I love the design here. It was very forward-thinking for 1954, and it was part of the innovation that would really drive some of the legendary designs, 55 and 56 tops in particular, and then would kind of set the stage for a lot of their other designs throughout the late 1950s and early 1960s. So an early picture-in-picture here from the Topps Company, their first attempt at it in 1954. Now you flip the card over, and you've got some very interesting things here. This goes to show you how different communicating baseball stats and stories from 1954 to now. I mean, now you get some stats, but you also have, you know, your advanced stats. You also have, you know, the players' Twitter handles or Snapchat handles. And in 1954, it was pure old-fashioned literature. You look at the top, Joseph Patrick Coleman, pitcher, Baltimore Orioles, and you've got a pretty lengthy bio on him becoming a 10-year man. That was a pretty big deal, of course. He had a little more control over his career at that point in time. By the way, his career didn't last much longer. I'm sure that's purely coincidental. And much like Topps did back in the day, two lines, one for the year before, one for his career. And then you had, not just on Joe Coleman's cards, but on a lot of cards, you had this comic panel called Inside Baseball, and you had this very 1954-esque style of comic books here, these cartoons, just describing some of the highlights. Like, he was a leader in high school, he was the captain of the football, baseball, and hockey teams. Of course, he grew up in Massachusetts, so that shouldn't be too surprising. But, you know, baseball winning out here, and here he has a pretty lengthy career now with the Baltimore Orioles. And, of course, the Topps logo and card number in the upper left-hand corner. And I love the old Topps logo, that kind of Davy Crockett, Wild Wild West typeface there. So you have a lot of information packed in here. But one of the cool things about this is that it also has a 1954 feel in terms of color selection. You've got green, you've got this red, you got pink, you got light green, you got this light white, which kind of turned tan with the cardboard stock. So a great look here. Now, one of the frustrating things, and this is fascinating too, if you're somebody who collects a lot of 54 Topps cards, the big frustration is the backs of the cards don't match. And what I mean by that is the way that the Topps Press printed the cards in 1954, if you had one card, you know, on its side with the number up top, and you flip the card over, then, you know, when you flip it over from right to left, then the card would be right side up. But then the next card, if you set it down that way on the back and flipped over right to left, it would be upside down. So if you collect a handful of these and you put them in sequential order, and you put them in order by the numbers on the back, and you make sure that they're all lined up, if you were to flip the stack over and go card to card, you would have one card right side up, one card upside down, the next one upside down, the next three right side up. So it's very helter-skelter. And for collectors, that's a very tough thing for some people to deal with. So, you know, if you're finding a lot of 54 Topps cards and you notice that they're not quite matching up, it's not just you. It's the entire printing run from that year. Now, one other final thought, not only about this card, but a lot of the cards that you're going to see, especially from 54 through, I'd say, probably 63 with my collection, is you're going to see some cards that are just thoroughly abused. And this Joe Coleman card is no exception. I can also tell you, without telling you who the player is, because I only have three cards from 1957, and I pulled this one player in particular because, you know, a lot of the stories behind him. So you'll have to find out who that is next week, next Tuesday. But these cards are pretty beaten up, and I'll be honest with you, I don't care. I really don't care. You know, much like we've had the discussion before about the dreaded manager card, and some people like the manager cards because that's the only way that you could get a Hall of Fame player was not when he was playing, but when he was managing. And I understand that argument. I still don't like manager cards, but, you know, much like some people will take manager cards because it's an easier avenue to some of the bigger Hall of Fame name players from a generation or two before, I'll take vintage cards in any condition because I'm not looking to sell them. I'm not looking to, you know, pay off my mortgage. I'm looking to collect them, plain and simple. And I really don't mind the condition. Now, if they're just ripped in shreds and covered in tape, well, that's something, you know, I'm not crazy about those. But if it's something in this condition like the Joe Coleman card or, like I said, the 57 Topps card you'll see next podcast, I really don't mind. Sure, I'd love to have it in a better condition, and most of my older cards are in much better condition, but there's something that comes through from 1954 that's in excellent or very good condition, I'll take it, because you know what? As a baseball fan and as a collector and as a buff of history, this is something from 1954. You know, you can have a penny from 1954. You can have, you know, a magazine from 1954. I mean, chances are you've run into old National Geographic or Life magazines and you've thumbed through them. And it's kind of neat. But there's just something really neat about getting a baseball card from, in this case, 1954. This card has passed through so many hands, so many shoe boxes, and perhaps a couple of bike wheels. I just find it fascinating that here we are 63 years later, and now it's sitting in my home and hopefully for a very, very long time. But the, you know, the condition of the cards, I'm really not that concerned about. And of course it drives down the price. So if I find a lot of old cards on eBay or at a garage sale or whatever, I can get a card like this, which, you know, in mint condition would probably sell for $20, I can get it for less than two. And I'm perfectly fine with that. In fact, this card came from a set of cards that I bought on eBay. And it was just a lot of like 20, 25 cards, most of them pretty beaten up. And I think I got it for like $12. And again, for me, you know, yeah, I'm paying 50 cents for a beat up card, but, you know, again, it's a 63 year old card. It's a first year Baltimore Orioles. Joe Coleman was, as you'll find out, a decent player who gave birth to a very decent pitcher. There's three generations of Colemans in Major League Baseball. So it's kind of neat to have this piece of history in my hand here and for only a few cents. So when it comes to vintage cards, you know, unless I, you know, if I somehow were to one day stumble across a 54 Topps pack and I were to open it, I would be a little upset if the big slab of 63-year-old gum ruins the Mickey Mantle card that it's sitting on. But, you know, for the most part, I'm totally cool with, you know, just finding old lots of cards for a few bucks and hanging on to them. Because as you can also see, just by looking at this particular card, it's not in good shape, and if you don't preserve it now, it's probably going to be dust in a few years. And there's not a whole lot of product from the 1950s out there. It's well known, you know, what the Topps company did in 1952. They had so many baseball cards left over by the time the 1953 line came out. You know, they loaded cases of them onto a barge and dumped them in the Atlantic Ocean, you know. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of product from around them. And it's great even just to have one of these cards, even though it's not Hank Aaron, it's not Willie Mays, it's not Ernie Banks. You know what? It's my card, and and I'm glad to have it. Now, as for Joe Coleman, a very interesting story. Again, this is Joe Coleman Sr., not the Joe Coleman that you're probably familiar with. This Joe Coleman was born in Medford, Massachusetts, and he started pitching in 1942 with the Philadelphia Athletics. And even in 1942, the Athletics weren't a total laughingstock. In fact, if you ask anybody who follows Philadelphia baseball, because the Phillies were just as abysmal as the Athletics were back then, it wasn't until the Phillies won the National League pennant in 1950, which also coincided with some infighting in the Mack family as Connie Mack was getting much older and, you know, there was a transition of power. It wasn't until 1950 that Philadelphia really became a Phillies town, and that would eventually set the stage for the A's to leave for Kansas City in 1955 and then later on to Oakland. So here in 1942, here comes Joe Coleman, and he appears in one game in 1942, and things are looking pretty good, but this is also during the time of World War II. So 19-year-old Joe Coleman goes overseas, serves in the military from 1943 to 1945, comes back stateside in 1946, getting his feet wet once again. And he actually was able to churn out an all-star season in 1948. He was 14-13 with a 4.09 earned run average. And for the Philadelphia Athletics, that was pretty darn good. So he was named to the all-star team. Then the following season, he had a 13-14 record, but a 3.86 earned run average. Didn't earn himself all-star honors back then. But again, by Philadelphia Athletic standards, that was pretty darn good. Now, as the fortune started sliding downwards in the 1950s, so did Coleman. And he would find his way heading to the Baltimore Orioles, traded by the Athletics with Frank Fanovich for Bob Kane. And then Joe Coleman would be one of the original Orioles in 1954, putting up a fairly decent record again, 13-17. The Orioles were not that good. Again, they were the former St. Louis Browns, but he still has 13-17 record, 3.50 earned run average. And for one of the few times in his career, he threw more strikeouts than walks. You know, control was not necessarily a big thing. It was just, can he get the win? Can he get the out? But that was starting to become a thing in the 1950s, and Coleman was able to do that. And the funny thing is, Joe Coleman, even though he was with a bad Orioles team, because he threw 103 strikeouts and because he did have a pretty decent earned run average, he was actually in the MVP voting that year. So he had a few very excited voters in Baltimore, I guess, putting in first place votes for him. He was not a close finisher here. He finished 19th in voting. Yogi Berra would win the MVP award in the American League that year. But goes to show you that even though you look at his numbers and go, he was good enough for Baltimore to where you could pretty much call him the ace of the team, started 32 of 33 games for the Orioles. Now, I mentioned on the back of the baseball card, he became a 10-year man. Well, you could have a little more control over your destiny with the 10-5 rule. And I don't think it's coincidence that after the 1955 season, in fact, not even after the 55 season, midway through the 55 season, the Orioles, couldn't move him anywhere, so they just released him. Boom. There you go. Get out of here. Of course, he had a pretty rough start in 1955, to be honest with you. He appeared in just six games, had an 0-1 record and a 10.80 earned run average. So not a good start to the 55 season. But he did get picked up by the Detroit Tigers, and it would turn out he would end his major league career in 1955 with the Tigers. He went 2-1 with Detroit, 3.20 earned run average. And at the age of 32, his career was done. Now, even though his professional career would wrap up at the end of the 1955 season, the Coleman name would stay alive and well as Joe Coleman Sr. gave birth to Joe Coleman Jr. in 1947, and Joe Coleman Jr. had a much longer career playing with several teams, the Senators, Tigers, Cubs, A's, Blue Jays, Giants, and Pirates. From 1965 to 1979, he was an all-star with the Tigers in 1972, and Joe Coleman Jr. was a very solid relief pitcher, finishing his career with a 142 and 135 win-loss record and a 3.70 earned run average. And it's an interesting story. I don't want to spend too much time on Joe Coleman Jr., but it is an interesting story if you want to look it up on his career with the Oakland A's. And he had quite a bit of success with the A's in 77 and 78. But this was the time when Charles Finley was just trading everybody under the sun. He couldn't keep up with the higher contracts and the free agent market opening up back then. So he tried to trade every player that he could. Well, he couldn't move Joe Coleman, so he was going to send him down to the minor leagues, and Coleman refused the assignment. And of course, he was a 10-5 guy as well by this point in time. So eventually, the A's waived him. The Toronto Blue Jays pick him up off waivers, and Finley was trying to negotiate with the Blue Jays to basically trade him back. He was going to offer him twice what the Jays paid for in waiver charges. But the Jays went, no, we're not going to, because they thought that Finley found a higher bidder that he could sell him to. And that would prove out to be true. It was actually the Pittsburgh Pirates. They were trying to go after him, and eventually they would get him in 1979. But very funny story, very Charlie Finley, no doubt about that. But yeah, Joe Coleman Jr. had a very good career, again, from 1965 to 1979. And Joe Coleman Jr. gives birth to Casey Coleman in 1987, while Joe Coleman Jr. was becoming a pitching coach and moving around the minor leagues and major leagues. You know, he gets involved in a relationship. He makes Casey Coleman. And Casey was in the major leagues for a few years. He's still bouncing around the minor leagues right now. His last major league appearance came back in 2014 with the Kansas City Royals. And he was a teammate of Chris Sale at Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers. So three generations of Colemans. You have Casey Coleman now. You have Joe Coleman Jr. prior to that in the 1960s and 70s. And in the 1940s and 50s, you have Joe Coleman Sr. pictured on the Topps card that we were looking at right now. Now, one final thought in this podcast about all the stories that are in these cards, or in this card. I mean, there's a lot going on here. There is one common denominator with this player, and that is Bill Veeck. And Bill Veeck was the owner of the St. Louis Browns. Of course, he owned the Cleveland Indians before then. Later on, would own the Chicago White Sox twice. Well, he moved on from Cleveland for various reasons. I highly recommend another book for you to check out, Veeck as in Wreck. That was Bill Veeck's autobiography, which was, you know, there was a little bit of a ghostwriter there too, but he wrote that back in... it was originally, I think, 1960, and then they did an updated version in, I think, 1985, something like that. But Veeck as in Wreck is just an outstanding book, and he'll give you the whole rundown of how he gave up a really successful team in Cleveland, picked up the St. Louis Browns, much like Philadelphia with the Phillies and Athletics, you know, if you believe Bill Veeck. St. Louis wasn't a Cardinals town until Augie Bush and the Anheuser-Busch company bought the Cardinals back in, I want to say it was 52. So, you know, there was still some competition, even though the Browns on the field were not as good as the Cardinals. They both played at the rickety Sportsman Park. In fact, the Browns owned Sportsman Park. Veeck would sell Sportsman Park to the Cardinals. And that's one of the common themes with... the St. Louis Browns and Bill Veeck. Well, actually, anywhere Bill Veeck was, he was always, you know, running on his last dime. He'd somehow find a way to make some money or bring in some money. But St. Louis in the early 1950s, the Cardinals' previous owner was in some hot water with tax evasion, I think. He was about to get hauled in by the IRS. He was looking for a buyer. Veeck had bought the Browns thinking that, you know, the Cardinals would eventually have to relocate because, you know, back then Los Angeles was a pretty hot location. You know, Major League Baseball was looking to grow there. Anywhere to, you know, again, buff the growth or rebuff the growth of the Pacific Coast League as a legitimate major league. And so he thought that the Browns could be the only team in St. Louis after some point in time. Well, that, of course, didn't happen. And Augie Bush buys the Cardinals, and Bill Veeck realized immediately, okay, I can't compete with the financial backing that Augie Bush and the Anheuser-Busch company has. There's just no way I'm going to survive. So after 1952, he's looking to relocate the Browns to either Milwaukee, where he got his ownership experience started. He ran the original Milwaukee Brewers in the 1930s and 40s. And he couldn't get a word in edgewise there because the Braves were able to finagle their way out of Boston and go there. So the next best option was moving to Baltimore. And he had a plan in place to leave St. Louis, got everything set up with Baltimore, was just going to basically transfer the team from one city to another. Well, Major League Baseball owners back then, this was the old guard. And, you know, I'm not talking like the George Steinbrenner, Marge Schott, you know, rough and tough ownership. I mean, we're talking the Wrigley family, the Comiskey family, the O'Malleys, the Yawkeys, the Briggs family. I mean, this was the old guard. This was an old boys club. And they didn't like anybody who didn't wear black and white suits and who didn't color within the lines. Bill Veeck did not color within the lines. And after some of the stunts he pulled to not only gain ownership of the Cleveland Indians, but also to maintain a very successful ball club there in the shadow of the Yankees and the Giants and some of the other more established clubs, Major League Baseball had it out against him. And of course, you know, Veeck would poke the lion and, you know, try to, you know, pull a fast one over the owners whenever he could. But, you know, you have to think too with St. Louis, it was, you know, Eddie Goodell and, you know, he upset a lot of owners with the stunt of putting a midget up to bat, even though in Veeck as in Wreck, it was actually part of an advertising ploy with one of his sponsors, believe it or not. But, you know, he ruffled the feathers of the old guard so much that they went out of their way to obstruct Bill Veeck from moving the team to Baltimore. So basically, the 1953 season was the lamest of a lame duck season a club could have. And he just withered on the vine in St. Louis. And then finally, he couldn't just move the team. He had to sell it to a group of people in Baltimore. So the Orioles came about in 1954. But what connects Bill Veeck to the Orioles and, as in the case of this Joe Coleman card, the Philadelphia Athletics, when the Athletics were in trouble, as I mentioned, they're fighting with the Phillies for supremacy in Philadelphia. Well, Connie Mack Sr., who had owned the A's and had managed the A's for 50 years, well, he's getting old. He's starting to get dementia. There's members of the Mack family. His sons are taking over control of the team. Well, naturally, especially in sports or any kind of big dollar business, if you don't have a clear transition plan moving forward, then things get really messy. Just ask the Lakers right now. But things got very, very messy in Philadelphia with the Mack family and the A's. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the Phillies get to the National League pennant in 1950, or they get to the World Series. They win the pennant in 1950. And all of a sudden, the Phillies have some young, exciting talent. The A's are now withering on the vine. So by 1953, the A's are looking to move around. Well, here's Bill Veeck, who just sold his team to Baltimore. Well, he wants to take the A's, and he wants to move them to, get this, Los Angeles. And again, in Veeck is in Wreck, he gives out all the details, but he had a plan in place and people in place and money in place to move the team to Los Angeles. And he would have broken virgin territory. Major League Baseball in Los Angeles would have helped Major League Baseball stomp down the Pacific Coast League and, you know, basically take away any threat of them becoming a legitimate Major League team. Well, again, the old guard, they don't want Bill Veeck back in the game here. So the A's got sold I forget his name, but he was a good buddy of the Yankees in Kansas City. So the A's move to Kansas City essentially become a farm club for the Yankees. And, you know, the Kansas City A's were doomed to fail anyways. Eventually, Charlie Finley buys the A's. As soon as Finley bought them in, I think it was 1960, he was looking to move them. He tried Dallas. He tried San Antonio. He finally ends up in Oakland. It's funny how Bill Veeck is connected here. You know, he tried to get the A's, couldn't. He eventually would weasel his way back into owning the Chicago White Sox in 1959. That was the first stint that he owned them. But he tried to get baseball to Los Angeles first, and he bemoans this in his book, the way that Major League Baseball eventually ended up there. First of all, you had the Dodgers and Giants moving to California. So the Dodgers settle in L.A., the Giants settle in San Francisco. Well, the American League, and remember, too, this was when the American League and National League were two totally different brands of baseball. They were under the Major League Baseball umbrella. But the American League did things differently than the National League and vice versa. So the American League goes, hey, we want a piece of that pie. And they expand in 1961. They create the Angels. But again, the owners looking to, you know, grab every dollar that they can, especially Walter O'Malley, put the Angels through just this ridiculous series of steps to get approved and where can they play. And, you know, they made the arrangement where they had to play in that bandbox Wrigley Field the first year. Then they had to play in Dodger Stadium, or Chavez Ravine, as it was called back then, for 4 years after that. So the Angels had no chance of, you know, really creating their own identity and you know, getting up off the ground, because they had to pay the bills for Walter O'Malley and Chavez Ravine. And, you know, they had to play in this ridiculously minor league, you know, ballpark in their first year. So the first 5 years of Angels history is rocky. And, you know, that's something that Bill Veeck tried to prevent by just moving the sad sack A's team out to L.A. And who knows? I mean, this is one of those great what ifs in sports. What if, you know, Bill Veeck beat the Dodgers and Giants and, you know, got out to Los Angeles first? Well, I can tell you the Dodgers probably still would have moved out to California because the A's were not that great. But, you know, the Giants, they may have ended up in Minneapolis. I know Horace Stoneham, there's another old guard owner there. You know, Stoneham had a minor league team in Minneapolis, the Millers. And he was prepared to move the Giants to Minneapolis and instead, you know, opts for San Francisco. And who knows, you know, maybe the Minnesota Twins wouldn't be around because that wasn't an exit strategy for Calvin Griffith, another old guard name there, you know, when he moved the first Washington Senators up there in 1961. So a lot of great what ifs there. And so many of them tying into this one baseball card, you know, two teams that Joe Coleman played for, the Orioles, nay, Browns, and the Athletics, you know, both pursued by Bill Veeck, and then his son, Joe Coleman Jr., playing for Charlie O. Finley, who eventually got the Athletics that Bill Veeck was trying to move out of Philadelphia. So it's kind of neat, you know, how this all comes together in this one little baseball card. But it's a classic, and even though it's beaten up, even though it's not necessarily a star player, it's one of my favorite cards because it is an incredible piece of history and so many great stories tied into the player and the teams and, of course, the history of card collecting. So there you go, card number 156 from 1954, Joe Coleman, formerly of the Philadelphia Athletics, but very carefully airbrushed into the new Baltimore Orioles in 1954 tops. If you have any thoughts about this 54 set or Joe Coleman or anything else that I talked about, there's a whole lot in that discussion there. Feel free to chime in at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And again, pass along the message for all your collecting friends to get on board Wax and Gum Stains and talk the hobby with us. And a reminder, we're scaling back the podcast just for now. We'll see where it goes. But once a week, new podcast coming out on Tuesdays, and we'll do a flashback Friday on our Friday show. And hopefully we'll be able to bring back some memories, help you out in listening to our archives, whatever the case is. And I do hope next Tuesday we have that distribution news to share with you. I just haven't gotten an official word yet, but hopefully that's coming down the pike very shortly. So next Tuesday, via Audioboom and iTunes, and perhaps another platform, we will be bringing you a look at 1957 tops. not quite as artistic as the 1954 top set we're talking about. And later, the 55 and 56 cards, which I don't have any right now, but do some Google images searches and you'll see how nice those cards were. While the 57 top set wasn't quite as artistic, it took a giant leap forward for not only the Topps Company, but for baseball cards in general. Of course, by 1957, Bowman was gone. Topps was the king of the hill for more than two decades moving forward. We'll talk about that set and our random pull. It's a player and a team I think you're really going to enjoy in our next podcast. Again, the new podcast a week from today, next Tuesday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you again for listening to Wax Ecstatic.